Hi, everybody. I'm Ashish, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
thank you for that amazing presentation. I really enjoyed it a lot, and it's been fantastic. I'm going to settle down in a minute or two, and I just want y'all to know that I voted for somebody else for a different speaker tonight. Didn't work out that way, but maybe next year. It is a huge privilege and an honor to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. Today's a really, really special day. Just June 10th is a special day in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we get to be here gathered together. It's been a couple of years, and this is amazing, and I was so excited to be able to, I knew I would be seeing familiar faces and friends that I haven't seen in a long time. But one of the things that I was thinking about was not just our anniversary here that we get to gather together and to celebrate in Alcoholics Anonymous, but Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. I was reading this morning where it said in June 1945, a historic gathering took place in Cleveland, Ohio. It commemorated AA's 10th anniversary. And a little bit further down it says, Bill stated that June 10th was a day for congratulations, for thanksgiving, and for celebration, and that AA could not have been but for others. The magnitude of that does not escape me. I often reflect about the fact that I'm still alive, and I didn't think that that would be possible, or that I would be here. I was asked earlier, are you going to tell the truth, or are you going to tell a lie? So I'm just going to tell you right now that there's three things that I can tell you that are truth. My name is Hashish. I am an alcoholic. I was born in Puerto Rico. I have a home group, 5:30 at Main Street. We meet on Mondays and Wednesdays at 5:30. We'd love to have you there if you're ever visiting, coming through, or would just like to join us. I have a sponsor. Her name is Dawn, and she's here tonight. For those things, I'm profoundly grateful. The rest that I'm going to tell you tonight is just my interpretation of what happened in my life. It may be true and it may not be true, but I certainly perceived it to be true. And, my perception of the events that happened has changed and how I relate to those things as I've grown up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, for that, I'm very grateful. I can't tell you, for just to give you a little bit of background, I already mentioned that I am Puerto Rican. I was born to very young parents. They were partiers. If you cannot tell that by my name, I don't know what to tell you. I do have a half-sister named Crystal. That should tell you enough. And I have, and it was two girls, and we were 11 months apart. Her name is Sasha. And our parents took us everywhere. Part of that is our culture. Part of that is how we relate. That's what we do. There's a lot of alcohol, liquor. One side of my family, my dad's side of my family, is they were just mired in secrets and just a lot of illness. And nobody ever talked about anything. My mom's side of the family, they're young, they're loving, they're just fun to be around. And they're a lot to take in too. What I can tell you is that very early on we moved a lot. My parents drank a lot. We didn't know where we might wake up even then. I was not drinking at that time on a regular basis. I was just a little kid sleeping on the station wagon, waiting for our parents. And that was just normal. It was fun. It was crazy. My dad moved a lot, as I mentioned. So there was very early on a whole lot of unmanageability, a lot of chaos, and I grew up in that. I can tell you that as time went on, that unmanageability, there was a lot of violence in our home, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of wrecks, car wrecks, oh my God, we were always in the car too. And that was all par for the course. My dad would just wake up one day and we're moving to Michigan. That's how I know how to speak English, because that was where I went to kindergarten. And we were there, and it was at that moment that I knew I was very different. It was at that moment that I knew that I was different from everybody else, because there were only two Hispanic little girls, that was my sister and I, in that whole school, in that whole area. You know, from there we were a year there. We went to New York. We were in Miami. My dad took my sister away from my mom and took us back to Puerto Rico. And that was the kind of, today I know that's kidnapping, but at that time I didn't, you know. That was the kind of stuff that we lived. There was a lot of uncertainty all the time. Fights would break out all the time. No rhyme, no reason. You just didn't know what it would be like. After that, you know, we went back to Puerto Rico. I was there, we were there for a period of a few years. I was raised and I went to parochial school, so Catholic school. And, you know, it was somewhere between third and fourth grade that I knew that something was very different, very wrong. And I don't know if I just, my earliest memories as a child have always been of, I don't want to be here, I just don't know why. I don't fit in. I don't like being around people. This is why speaking in front of people is so difficult. I would love to, you know, I'm not a speaker. I would love to just go get a cup of coffee with you and get to know you. That's my personality. And for someone who's always been trying to sort of blend in with a background, not be noticed, not be known, you know, it's always been very hard. And our family was such that, you know, there were a lot of secrets, and we never spoke of what those secrets were. I can tell you that those things always felt like I never knew what I was supposed to be doing. Everybody else seemed to know what they were doing, and you never told what was going on. You always looked put together, and when all else fails, you lie. You know, and that was how we lived. And so the more put together I am, probably the more uncomfortable I am. Even today, I know that about myself. I was one of those kids that I was afraid to ask for directions. I was afraid to ask what was I supposed to be doing. I always observed what was going on, what other people would do, and then I would do the same thing. I wish I could tell you that I outgrew that. I have not. I can tell you that and when my kids started going to school and I didn't know about carpool lines, I went early to the school so I could park somewhere and start seeing what everybody was doing so I would know what to do, you know. And that has been pretty much, you know, that's a snapshot of my personality and what I've done. And showing up, you know, I could be somebody that could be incredibly well prepared, and at the moment that I was supposed to suit up and show up, I would not. I would get drunk. I would not show up. I would be sick. As a kid, I would be sick. I was one of the two students that were picked for the spelling bee to compete. I got sick. I didn't. Later on in life, I'm supposed to be going to an interview, and so I drink and I go to jail. But I do call them after I get out of the jail, and they do have me come in for the interview and hire me. So they were the ones that got me my attorney. So we do know how to pick our people, and we do recognize them, and they recognize us too. And I just, there was a lot of insanity in our life. There was those years in Puerto Rico were the only stability that I knew. My mom moved here because my dad was threatening to kill my mom, and we were supposed to come here just for a year. That was 1985. I'm still here. And what I can tell you is that was incredibly painful, and I absolutely hated my mom for that. It was crazy over there. It was unmanageable over there, but it was home. And being over here and not understanding Southern English was so traumatic. Not understanding what or how things were or they were supposed to be, puberty hit. I'm in eighth grade. I look like a freak. I speak like a freak because I am one probably at that point. Mm-hmm. And everybody had really big hair. I was only used to having a uniform, homemade uniform, shorts, swimsuits. That was my wardrobe. I did not know how to dress until I got here. So it was very intimidating, and I didn't know what to do. And I had a fight with my sister that very first day before that night before we went to school. So I ran into a door, and I had a scar on my face also, just to make it a little more interesting. So, and that... definitely marked for me a turn in everything about to how I related to alcohol and how I used alcohol. Up until that point, alcohol had always been around. Never thought anything about it. It was no big deal. I could buy alcohol in Puerto Rico at all times, anytime. It was never an issue. When I moved here, there was just something that happened. There was just a flip. I stopped doing everything. I absolutely could not stand going to school. I didn't speak for an entire year that I was there. My sister was the complete opposite of me, so I never felt it necessary to make friends because we moved often, and she was everything that I wasn't. I could think, and she could do. So I would come up with an idea, she would execute. She was very outgoing, very vivacious, very friendly. She was just all of those things. And I was not. I've always been quiet. I've always been pretty reserved. And so it was, the dynamic worked well. And again, we're back to being the only two Hispanic little girls in the school in Cobb County. At that time, it was very different than what it is today. Knowing that you didn't fit in, knowing that you stood out, knowing that people didn't know where to place you because they didn't have a category for you or a label for you. And I could give you many examples of that, but that was a little bit traumatic. I just started retreating, and I stopped going. We started moving again. And by the time I was in 10th grade, I can tell you that summer, right after that summer of 8th grade, I went home and my mom shipped me off over there, and that was when the magic happened. Because for me, it was just, up until that point, it just felt like I never knew what I was supposed to be doing. I was always paranoid, always afraid, always concerned, never knowing, just feeling lost. And I went back home and it felt like I could breathe, and somebody, you know, we could party, so we did. And for me, it was taking a drinking alcohol, and from that moment on, the magic that happens of it just lights out, I don't care. It was, I could breathe, I didn't have to think, I didn't have to worry, I didn't have to care. And I've been a blackout drinker from the very, very first drunk, and I didn't really know what that was. I didn't know the name for it. I could tell you that I had a lot of lost time as my drinking progressed. And my drinking was fast and I was furious. And from that point forward, by the time that I went to like 6 different high schools, I stopped. I couldn't stand it anymore. I couldn't deal with it. So I dropped out. I was going back and forth between Puerto Rico and over here. I was telling my mom I was one of those people that I could and had the ability to build everything up. I could get myself back on track. I could do school. I could be working a job. I could be doing all the right things. And I would just go on a bender and it would just be all gone. And from the time I was 15 years old, I was in the system because I ran away with a drug dealer and... My sister did not want me to go alone, so she went with me. And my mom is like this hardcore, natural-born Al-Anon. She was like, I did it for 14 years with your dad. No way am I going to do this with y'all. So she found us, got him extradited, pressed charges, got the FBI, you know, and then my sister not long after that got shipped off to treatment. Long-term treatment, not long, a few years after that, but I was in the system for a very long time, and going in front of the same judge, I had started having the consequences to my drinking started to escalate, obviously, from that point forward. I had DUIs, I had assault, you know, drugs, all the crazy stuff, you know, right, that comes along with that, the multiple charges with everything that, with the insanity of the drinking, the violence escalated. I was going to Puerto Rico so that I wouldn't have to be over here. My mom finally said, you cannot leave until you take your GED, and at the very least, which I did so I could go over there. And, you know, I was going over there so that I could just party with my dad, who is an incredibly charismatic, very fun-loving guy, very crazy guy, And everybody loved him. I look exactly like my mom, so obviously him and I were just not gelling together. And it got really bad. Over there we have, if you've ever been, you know that there's a, you lock everything with keys and padlocks and everything else. So he would just like lock me in and he would leave. And I'd be locked in for however long until he got back, or he'd be drunk, I'd be drunk, and we'd be chasing each other around with knives, you know, things like that, that were just sort of not normal, I know now, but, you know, it's that at that time, I didn't really think of it. So by the time that, you know, I'm coming and I'm going in front of the same judge, my sister had been there as well, I can tell you that I was, every time that I went to jail, I was raised knowing right from wrong. I was raised knowing God. I was given a loving God. It was never preached in my house in that way. As a matter of fact, my dad was like, God goes everywhere I go. I was like, okay, well, that's great. That's, you know, but I also know that it was that teacher, and I don't want to miss this because I think it was important, somewhere around third or fourth grade, I can tell you that it was a point that I knew that something was going to be different, but I didn't know what. But I just a certain level of, I don't know if it's a, I don't know if to call it a darkness or a depression or what, but I remember that teacher, that religion teacher saying, if you kill yourself, you're going to hell. And I thought, you know, I can't kill myself, you know, I'm going to have to, like, live longer. And I was one of those kids that was always hoping that something would happen so that I wouldn't have to be here. And the thing about alcohol towards the end, and as I continued to drink, and as I continued to, and the insanity continued to unfold, because I could not not drink, and I drank, on, and I would come to, I was a blackout drinker, so I would come to, and I would be on the wrong side of the road, running somebody off the road. Don't know what happened to that person, hearing sirens, passing out, waking up, cops knocking on the door, we need to see your car. You know, having my mom come to visit me in jail was one of the worst experiences that I had. Living in jail was not fun. You know, I started using pills when I was in jail because I needed to somehow get through not drinking. All of that was very normal, and I didn't know how things were going to be. I didn't know where I was going to end up. And I can tell you that the places that I woke up, the people that I was with, and I didn't, it wasn't that I went out a lot. It was just that the people that were coming into my life got lower and lower, and the things that I would wake up to, and just thinking to myself, just the incomprehensible demoralization and the shame, that just came, you know, with waking up one more time and saying, God, why do I have to be here? I don't want to be here, you know, just please take me. I was like, I thought I was good because I was like a martyr and a willing sacrifice, like, for somebody. And I used to really see myself like that. And that's always been something that I've had to, finding the joy of living and being here with you tonight and the fact that I'm happy to be alive is a huge, huge testament to Alcoholics Anonymous and what it can do in someone's life, and I'm profoundly grateful for that, and I don't see that lightly. As I was saying, I was going in front of that same judge, and this is, I told you about the job that I got, and I told you about the these employers that after the DUI that I got, I was hired with them, and they got me that lawyer, and it was that attorney, the one that really truly brought the message of Alcoholics Anonymous into my life, because I lied to him every single time I was in there. He's like, I need you to tell me what was going on. I need you to tell me about this. How much did you drink? What did you do? And I was lying. I was lying about it all, and he was calling me out on every single one of those things. I told him that I would not be back for another course, you know, because I was very smart. And I was back again, you know, and because I couldn't drive at that time, I was in the car with him, I was captive audience, and he simply delivered the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me at that point. And he said, your best bet will be Alcoholics Anonymous, because the one thing that it differentiates it from any other treatment program is the fact that it is spiritually based. I have to tell you that during this time that my life is just spiraling out of control, and my faith, you know, the things that were happening at that time too, that not only did I not know the things that were, you know, I say that there were wrecks, obviously I would come to, and my face would be a mess, you know, I just didn't know what was going on, and I could never remember the things, and that created a sense of panic, because I didn't know what was going on or what had happened. And simultaneously, my sister is away in rehab, long-term rehab. So a couple of things are happening. In order for us to be able to go see her, we have to go to Al-Anon. Al-Anon is an amazing group, unless you're an untreated alcoholic sitting in the wrong room. At that point, it becomes one of the most painful experiences. And the level of anger is rising uncontrollably for me. And I feel like I don't know what's going on. And when I tell you that she was away at long-term treatment, we didn't see her for a very long time as well. So by the time I did get to see my sister, she was a completely different person. And that was devastating to me, because my life was spiraling out of control and she looked healthy and completely different. Now here was somebody, and here was the only person in my life that I felt knew me, understood me, partied with me, went everywhere with me, and she looked completely different. And she came back home. She joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to support her. And I met her sponsor at that time. Her name was Marcia. And after a year, my sister says, I don't need Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm good. And she is good. She smokes pot, she's good, she doesn't drink, doesn't have any other issues ever again. In the meantime, I'm homeless, I don't know where I'm going, she's picking me up, letting me sleep with her, and every time I get out of jail, I don't know what to do. Finally, I call my mom after one of those stints, and I said, I need help and I don't know what to do. And she's like, I don't know what, I can't help you, baby, but I know somebody that can. And she gives me my sponsor's, my sister's sponsor's number, Marcia's number. You know, there's some things God knew. He knows his kids, right? So, and he knows me. He knows that I can't talk about myself, my life. I can't talk, I don't want to talk to anybody about this. So I actually go to her because I figure that she knows me, knows my sister, knows my history. I need not tell her anything anymore. We're good. And it doesn't quite work that way. I know that now, today. But those are the things that, you know, I'm grateful that there was somebody that knew me. And she was I actually didn't stay the first time that I saw her. The second time she had me meet her. And I told her everything that was going on. And it was, again, after another jail stint. And after I told her, I said, these are all the things that are going on in my life. And she said, God, you're exhausting. A lot. And I had a lot of higher powers. I had a psychologist. I had a probation officer. I had a judge. I had a mom. I had a lot of higher powers in my life at that time. And I worked several jobs. I worked, you know, in order to be able to eat, pay my car insurance, drink at the time before that. It was fines and lawyers and everything else to do with that. So, and for whatever reason, I felt like I was very responsible and working, and I could hold a job, for the most part. I got sober after I got sober. I was unemployable. I couldn't hold a job. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't function very well at all. We'll get to that in just a moment, but this is, you know, for me, I was going to NABA. I thought I could, I could start there, and I didn't really know or plan on getting sober, staying sober, because I never could. The thing is that I could go a day. If I was in jail, I was sober, and I was okay with that. I was okay with being in a confined and contained environment because I knew that I would not drink and I would not be hurting someone else. And towards the end of my drinking, I actually would pray. And I would pray and I would say, God, you and I both know that I'm going to drink. Please keep me and everybody else safe, you know, because I don't know how to not drink. I don't know how to not do the things that I want to do. I don't know how to stay sober. I cannot stay sober. And I used to be under the impression that as long as I didn't drink like my dad or like my grandfather, who was always bumming a quarter at the Esquina Caliente, you know, bumming a quarter for a shot, I was fine, you know. But that's not what my alcoholism looked like. And so as long as I held a job, my dad was unemployed, we were good. As long as I wasn't violent like he was, I was good. At the end of my drinking, the violence showed up. And then after I put alcohol down, it really was out of control. And because I didn't know what to do with myself. I didn't know how to act or behave, and I was just constantly just full of so much emotion that I didn't know where to put, what to do with it, or anything like that. This lady very early on told me, Marsha, she's like, well, you've got a lot going on, so, and I love that line in the big book that it says, get to know your man. She took the time to get to know her woman. And she found out what I needed to do, where I was at, what my schedule was. And thankfully, she didn't say, well, you need to make 90 meetings in 90 days or you're going to get drunk, because I would have gotten drunk. I did not have the transportation nor the means to be able to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I love the fact that we can do that today in person or by Zoom. That's a blessing. But back then, I would go to meetings and I would leave and I would, you know, smoke pot, do other things, whatever else I could do that would keep me from drinking. That was all I wanted to do. And inevitably and invariably, everything, my first and only love was alcohol, and that's all I've ever wanted. I love the effect produced by alcohol. I love blacking out. I don't want to party with you. I just want to black out. I don't want to be around people. I just want to be left alone. I just don't want to feel. And I don't want to feel. I don't want to be here. For me, alcohol and drinking has been about getting me out of here, right now, lights out. And I'm okay with that. So any other drug that produced any or interfered with that ultimate outcome, I was not interested in. So it probably saved me from other things at the time. And once I was trying to stay sober, it didn't, obviously everything always leads back to alcohol, so I did not think I could stay sober. I did not tell anybody that I was sober. And I started working with this lady, and Marsha just said, I need you to go to, you know, a women's step study meeting, and I need you to go to a Big Book meeting and a speaker meeting. Everything else is optional, the kind of meeting that you go to. And I said, okay. And, you know, that's where my journey began in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful. And she spent a lot of time with me. I didn't know what to do with myself, and she gave me a safe place to go to because I needed that. I just, you know, for me, I was very grateful for her, for what she did for me. And there's a group of women, and so some of them are in this room, and they've been with me from the very beginning and from very early on, and I'm grateful. And the longer I'm here, the more I appreciate you coming back, you being here for me. I know that's kind of selfish, but it has given me life, and it gave me a direction when I had none. And you can imagine my surprise when I turned 21. I thought I'd be dead, and here I am, and I didn't know what to do. And I'm sober. I don't know what I'm going to do. My dad shows up and a few months later, and I'm about to drink. And my sponsor says, you might want to come over and bring that fourth step. We're going to do it. And we did the third step, and we did that fourth and fifth step. And, you know, my life was unmanageable for everybody to see. It was very apparent to anybody. It was chaos. I was a mess. And, you know, for me, the insanity of doing the same thing over and over, you know, I just could not get, you know, that idea that it was the first drink that gets you drunk. That, to me, was so dumb. I just didn't get that. It didn't make sense to me. I thought if that was the case, then you really had a problem. And so it took a while. It really took a while for the idea of powerlessness and how that manifested in that, you know, in my life and what that really meant. And, you know, after my dad showed up and I was almost ready, I was getting ready to drink, I just, she had me come over. And it wasn't but a month after that. It wasn't long after that that life changed. You know, I was early on in recovery, and my sister, right after my first year sober of sobriety, I celebrated, and she was there, actually. She was diagnosed with cancer. And by the time that she was diagnosed, they said that she had only 3 months to live. And I couldn't understand. I couldn't understand. And that's been a lot of my journey in sobriety. I mean, I have wrestled with God, spiritually speaking, you know, through a lot of things that I just don't get sometimes, and I'm not here to get it, and I get that today most of the time. I can accept that most of the time. But here was my sister who gets diagnosed. She got diagnosed on May 4th, 1998, and I mean, excuse me, 94, and did I say that my sobriety date is February 9th, 1993? If I didn't, it was right after that she got diagnosed. And my first year, and I could not fathom a life where she wasn't a part of it, because for all of my life, I'd wanted to not be here, and that wasn't her case. For all of my life, I would have given my life for her without a doubt, and I couldn't understand why her and not me, when we lived, had the same DNA, lived the same places, did the same people, ate the same food, went everywhere together. I mean, like, we just didn't know. That did not make sense to me. And so a lot of things were just, my world was turned upside down. And, you know, she actually passed away that year in December. So she, the time was longer. She passed away in December, and we buried on the 22nd, and we buried her on Christmas Eve. And I was in Puerto Rico, and we spent Thanksgiving together with my husband, and we did the rounds. And the next day, she got on a plane and she went home to die. I just had a really hard time. After that, it was just very difficult. And this is somebody that had put up with me, like I told you. I lightly brushed over the fact that I was pretty, you know, violent when I got sober. I didn't know what to do. I did a lot of things that only she was willing to put up with me. I don't know anybody else that would put up with me, because I didn't and couldn't put up with me. And I was very reckless when I first got sober. I drove recklessly. I was constantly wishing for something to happen to me. I was just one of those people that would go to Walmart, and thank God it was 24 hours at that time, and I'd get a buggy all filled up, and then I'd just walk out, you know. And I would do things like that because I didn't know what to do with myself. I would go to her house just so that I could pick a fight. And she was up for it sometimes, and sometimes she wasn't. She was my greatest love. And I just couldn't imagine it. And after she passed away, it just took a long time for life to take on a whole new rhythm. And I told you I was unemployable. It took a while for me to get past that. You know, what Alcoholics Anonymous has done is it has given me a safe place to come, to grieve, to learn how to do things differently, how to grow up, how to do life in different scenarios and different situations. I married in sobriety. I have raised my kids in sobriety. They have never seen us drunk. They've been in a sober home, although not always sane, and that's okay. You know, we have caused and inflicted damage and trauma. I tried to share that in my last minute, in one of my last talks, like, I think I might have done that, and my kid was, like, watching on Zoom, and she texts me, and she's like, no, you have. I'm like, so I'm setting the record straight. See, there's my truth, and there's her truth. The thing is that because I'm through Alcoholics Anonymous, what I have been given is a way to restore relationships. I have an amazing relationship with my mom today. I told her about this, and she said, please tell that organization, thank you. Thank you for saving your life and for her life. Because she's grown up, and I've grown up. And today she at least has one child who's alive. And I can't predict the future, but I'm pretty certain I wouldn't be alive if I wasn't sober. I certainly wouldn't want to be alive if I was. And I'm not quite sure that I would be out free, you know, enjoying y'all's company either. So there's much to be grateful for. I have some of the most amazing relationships, and from very early on, I can tell you that sponsorship put me in the middle of this program. I don't have it in me. I consider service work work. I've already told you that I don't volunteer. I am voluntold. I am okay with that. The people that I'm attracted to, that I love, and that I want what they have. I want the peace. I want the quality of life. I want to be around them. They're all in service work, so you invariably end up doing it, you know? I mean, it's like, you cannot not do it. So I say yes, you know, and through this process, I've gotten to do so many other different things, and I've gotten to live a pretty exceptional life. I don't take that for granted. I love my daughters, you know, and God is so gracious and so good. And He will always, I do believe, He will always give you something to smile about and rejoice over. My first daughter was, actually her due date was the same day that my sister passed away. And she was born 7 days earlier, so in December 15th she was born. And my second daughter was born in May, when my sister was diagnosed. And today I have a baby granddaughter. She's 2 years old, and her name is Sasha. You know, that's pretty special. And I get to do that. I get to live that life. I get to serve with you, live with you. I have a life inside Alcoholics Anonymous, and I get to take what you show me here outside, and I get to serve others outside. I get to show up and suit up for them. I know how to make amends. I know how to live a good life, and I want that peace. And most of the time, you know, I think I know where I'm constantly aiming for, even if I missed a mark, and that's okay, because Alcoholics Anonymous is about second chances over and over and over again. And as long as I don't drink, I believe that I have at least a chance at a do-over. And that, to me, is pretty amazing. This is, I thank you. I thank you for my life. I thank you for my family. I thank you for my relationships. I have so many amazing, beautiful, intimate relationships with quite a few of you. I love my home group. I love the people that show up, and I love that I get to do this with you. And sponsorship has been so key to all of that, because in and of myself, I don't come up with these great ideas. I like being by myself a little too much, and I'm okay with that, and that's a problem for someone like me at times. That is not something that really goes well. So I need to be with people that say, come on, let's go, it's time. And that's what my first sponsor did for me. That's what my current sponsor has continued to do for me. I don't do change very well, and I'm grateful for that. I've had 3 sponsors and, you know, during my sobriety, and my current sponsor has been with me for well over half my sobriety. And a couple weeks ago, I had a chance to go and see my first sponsor too, and I'm really grateful for that, because what she has given me and the foundation that she gave me has absolutely withheld and held up really well, because there's been a lot, we've been through a lot of life. Life is just life. So we've been through mental health illnesses, you know, we've been through friends family. We have been through relationships that have struggled, and I was thinking about, can I tell? Yeah? Okay. All right. So, you know, and it's important for me. I mean, I want to say that being in the middle of this program is hugely important, and I can tell you that alcoholism kills you, whether you're drinking or not. And I like to sometimes say that because it's really important. And double-digit sobriety. And I'm telling you this because Rebecca met me we were at a roundup, and she said, you know, we need to start a home group. And I said, okay. And she's done that all throughout our whole time together. And I just say, okay. I know how to say okay. I mean, you know, and so she said that. But it wasn't, and it was that home group that kept me and being responsible for opening up that door, the one that has absolute, that kept me sober for a long time. And we had two small babies, and our girls are 15 months apart, you know, and Robert wasn't going to meetings, and I was barely, and you know, and for me, this is just one more opportunity that I want to share this. It's not just about his journey, but mine as well, is that he actually ended up in a psych ward because he ended up trying to kill himself, you know, and again, stark raving sober. And, you know, those are the things that we deal with in sobriety. Those are things that we don't always just, that go away just because we were sober, you know. Those are the things that still come up and crop up, and I know that my girls are amazing, but I also feel for them because they've got our DNA. And so that can be an awesome thing, and it can be a painful thing, depends on the day. There's always throughout that, all of that, so much love, so much support, and I'm grateful that we've made it through. I'm grateful that we've gotten through those. I have no idea what the future holds. I do know that one of the things, as much fear as I've had in my life, one of the greatest gifts that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me has been the ability to feel the love in my life, because there used to not be enough. You know, there was just not enough alcohol, not enough money, not enough sex, not enough of anything to make me feel good or to keep me changed all the time. The love in these rooms and constantly pursuing God, my relationship, my personal relationship with God, has been something that has absolutely saved me. And I'm surrounded by people that are constantly challenging me, you know, to seek more, to seek further, to, you know, draw closer. And, you know, while it's been, I've had that spiritual wrestling, I also know that it has saved my life. And that religion teacher was the one that kept me alive probably long enough to find alcohol. Alcohol kept me alive long enough to find Alcoholics Anonymous, and in turn, you have given me the ability to have a real personal relationship with God, and for that, I'm profoundly grateful. Life is really good today. I know that I've been sitting here for a long time, and I just want to end with this because it's the one thing that always resonates with me. It's one of my favorite promises, if not my favorite promise in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for many years, we would say it in a meeting, and it says, the 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. Thank you for my life, and happy birthday.